Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is a Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 17th of February, these are our main stories. The annual security conference in Munich is underway, but this year Russia has not been invited. A British security guard at the embassy in Berlin has been jailed for passing secrets to Moscow. Are shoddy building standards to blame for the enormous death toll in Turkey's earthquakes? Also in this podcast, which big cat is making a return to India?
It's the only large carnivore species, that's gone extinct in modern-day India. So there was a real desire to reintroduce the cat to the country.
It reads like a who's who of the global security world. Presidents, prime ministers and diplomats, just some of those in attendance at the Munich Security Conference that's got underway a few hours ago. There is a notable omission, however, in that this year Russia didn't make the guest list. Topics up for discussion will be US-China tensions, climate change and, of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. A key question will be the extent of Western resolve in its support for Kyiv. A former Ukrainian Member of Parliament, Hanna Hopko, explained what she hoped to get out of the conference.
We need to mobilize the whole world. The idea of Ukraine winning this war this year, and why it's important, and not just to mobilize like tank coalition, fighter jets, Storm Shadow or ATACMS to conduct new counter-offensive. But I think we need to think wider, because Russian aggression against Ukraine from 2014, people are suffering.
The defence analyst, Jonathan Marcus, says there's no doubt that Ukraine will dominate the agenda at the meeting.
In terms of practical military assistance, we've obviously just had a meeting of NATO defence ministers and senior military figures. So that deals with the practical nitty-gritty of aid. But of course, also there is financial aid. There is the general bolstering of the political and diplomatic coalition backing the Kyiv government. So that's going to be an important element at this conference. And remember, whilst it's a conference of political leaders, analysts, journalists and so on, behind the scenes, there are a huge number of opportunities for bilateral meetings, multilateral meetings between officials. For example, the US Secretary of State is there. He'll be meeting his G7 colleagues at some point during the meeting. Financial aspects there of the Ukraine crisis probably on the agenda. And he'll also be meeting with his British, French and German counterparts. So a lot of informal, I suppose, diplomatic business on the sidelines, as well as the conference agenda that you see in the main auditorium, in the main hall.
But Ukraine will be looking for something more concrete, as it worries that the longer this war drags on, the more European and American support could wane.
Well, I think we are where we are. You know, the war is now almost a year old. I think we've seen a remarkable level of Western support. I don't think anything particularly practical is going to come out of the Munich Security Conference. I think we are entering a really crucial period of the next 2 to 3 months. We believe that the Russian offensive is already starting. It's a kind of rolling offensive that has probably begun. There's lots of talk of a Ukrainian offensive, perhaps a little later towards the spring. And I think that the Russian offensive, if it succeeds, is going to be a problem. If that is held and then the Ukrainians go on to the attack, that really is going to be a crucial moment. Because I think if Ukraine cannot demonstrate this year, as it did last year, that it can make a serious inroads into the territory that the Russians have seized, if it can't push the Russians back, then I think the questions about long-term support for Ukraine will begin to become louder. Clearly, you know, Ukraine cannot be supported in this war for a decade or more. There has to be an end in sight. And I think Ukraine demonstrating some real capability on the battlefield is important. That's why so many weapons are going to Ukraine over the coming weeks.
Jonathan Marcus, Russia may not have been invited to the Munich Security Conference, but it's keen to point out that it's not without friends. Its navy is today beginning military exercises off the coast of South Africa alongside Chinese and South African ships. The drills have been criticised by opposition politicians in South Africa who say it amounts to an endorsement of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But the government there insists it's taken a neutral stance on the conflict. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
For the next 10 days, Russian warships, one reportedly armed with hypersonic cruise missiles, will be conducting exercises off the east coast of South Africa. The government here points out that it hosts similar drills with all sorts of countries, including France and America. But the timing is awkward. The naval exercises coincide with the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and opposition politicians in South Africa have accused their government of siding shamefully with Moscow. The African continent is sharply divided over the Ukraine war. South Africa has sought to remain publicly neutral, but it has also made a clear show of strengthening ties with Russia and China. The United States has expressed concern about these Navy drills, and Ukraine's ambassador has called them very disturbing.
Andrew Harding. Well, nearly a year on from the full-scale Russian invasion, Ukrainian military officials say that there is still a steady stream of British volunteers trying to enlist in their armed forces. They're serving in a number of different battalions on the front lines. But the risks are high, with some killed or badly injured. The BBC has had exclusive access to a group of British fighters who've been on the front lines since the early days of the conflict. They spoke to our reporter, Emma Vardy, about why they'd come to fight in Ukraine and the sense of purpose it had given them.
As artillery rounds rain down from Russian tanks, a soldier's head peers out from a trench and instructions ring out from his radio.
The first time I ever experienced combat, we got hit by multiple missiles.
James, who's 30, had no military experience when he left England to travel to the conflict. But after spending much of the past year in the trenches, he's seen a lot.
I'm just looking up, and as I looked up, a tank round came straight through the bushes, straight for me. I'm going to get killed here right now. Facebook advertisement. It was all in Ukrainian, but I translated it. If you're not going to handle the gun, contact us.
James joined a battalion fighting in the east.
They said, we'll give you a month's training and we'll send you out on the front line. You'll be fighting in the Kharkiv district.
None of us have to be there.
He fought alongside Ava, a medic from the US, and other volunteers from all over the world.
I mean, all it takes for evil to conquer is good people to do nothing. I knew that I could help in some capacity. As far as I'm concerned, as you go into an environment like that, and if you die, you went out your own way.
She too came close to death from a tank round.
You still have shrapnel in your face.
Mm-hmm. Like I still have, like, there's a big piece of glass.
And as they became involved in operations to help recapture Ukrainian ground, it meant coming face to face with the enemy.
So we went on this attack. The whole of the Ukrainian front line pushed forward. I remember just going up the back of the tree line. Five prisoners was there.
What do we got here? A couple of Russian prisoners.
Their videos show a line of Russian soldiers being led away.
It was strange. It made it feel real.
British and international volunteers who enlist in the Ukrainian military are given a contract and a wage. But while they're welcomed in Ukraine, it often means leaving families behind at home.
I didn't find out till the day before he was going.
When Craig McIntosh, another British fighter, joined their unit, his brother Adrian had little warning.
I took the night off to spend time with him before he left. Took him to the airport, said not to stress or worry. That's the first I knew about it.
What was your reaction?
I was gutted.
Did you ever try and talk him out of it?
All the time. Even on the way to the airport.
Craig was a landscape gardener, but his sister Lorna says becoming a soldier was a childhood dream.
He always wanted to go in the army ever since he was little. He'd have all his toy soldiers. He always played with them.
I might message him on a Tuesday and I'd hear on a Thursday or maybe a Friday. One day I'd text him and never got nothing back. It was the 25th of August that I found out that he'd been shot. Crushed me.
After his body was repatriated, His friends and family followed a horse-drawn carriage carrying his coffin through the streets of Norfolk back in Britain.
It's heartbreaking. Like he said, he's got to do it for his own reasons, and that's what he's done. Your brother's a hero, but still don't bring him back.
Over the past year, 8 British fighters and aid workers have lost their lives. Since recording our interview, James has returned to the front lines.
Welcome back to Ukraine. We're ready for it. Slava Ukraini.
I've got a purpose in life out there. I'm happy. I've got my friends and I've got a purpose.
It's clear for many it means pursuing a noble cause, which comes with comradeship and adventure. But for those who pay the ultimate price, their families must reconcile the loss at home.
That report by Emma Vardy. For decades during the Cold War, Berlin was famed for its spies who risked all to share or sell forbidden information between East and West. Fast forward to today, and a man who worked as a security guard at the British Embassy in the German capital has been jailed for 13 years after being found guilty of passing secrets to Russia. With more, here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
You know, the cliche in these stories is to say it was just like a James Bond novel. Actually, it was a bit more like a John le Carré novel for anyone familiar with that spy writer, in the sense that, you know, his books, very ordinary, everyday people get caught up in major events. David Ballantyne Smith was what is called in the spy trade a walk-in. He wasn't recruited, he volunteered. He didn't actually literally walk in. What he did, he wrote to the Russian embassy in Berlin, said, look, I work as a security guard at the British embassy. I've got some stuff you might want. He had been going around filming and photographing documents, filming the embassy itself. Some of the documents we gather were very sensitive. There were trade documents. There was also some letters from the then Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Smith also stole personal information about the staff, where they lived, their mobile phone numbers. All of this he offered to the Russians.
So, how was he caught?
Well, the thing about spy trials is, you know, they can't reveal all the details, but it seems that somehow the embassy, the British embassy, cottoned on that these letters might have come from Smith. They thought it was him. And so, like the best spy stories, they set up a trap. As I said, he was a security guard. So what they did, they said to him, we've got a Russian defector here. Can you escort him into the building? And they asked him to take the man's details and said, obviously, destroy them afterwards. Well, Smith probably thought this was, you know, all of his Christmases come early. He's got this Russian spy on his hands and he can get their details. He wrote the man's details down, not realising that he was secretly being filmed. And then a woman approached him, saying she was a Russian agent, and, excuse the language, he told her, I don't trust the bastards I work for. And there was one other giveaway. Smith was spending money, but he wasn't withdrawing any from his bank account. So they worked out he must be getting money from somewhere. So I think, you know, there's a lesson out there for any would-be spies who are listening. If you are receiving secret cash, make sure you at least pretend to take money out of your bank account or someone is going to cotton on.
So, briefly, why did he do it? Was it just money?
Well, that's always, you know, the more interesting question. He said he was depressed. He told the court his wife had left him. He was drinking heavily. He now felt disgusted himself. But the court heard evidence that he was actually rather sympathetic to the Russians. There were pictures of him wearing the uniform of Russian-backed separatist militias in Ukraine. We also gather he was looking at strange conspiracy theorist websites, people like David Icke and Alex Jones. Either way, the judge said it was treachery. He wanted to hurt Britain with potentially catastrophic consequences. And that presumably explains the very heavy sentence. You can commit manslaughter in Britain and get less. He was sent to prison 13 years and 2 months.
Paul Moss, is the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak about to succeed where his predecessors Boris Johnson and Theresa May failed? As we record this podcast, sources say that Mr. Sunak, who's been holding talks in Northern Ireland, is inching closer to a workable deal with the European Union on trade on the island of Ireland. There's been a flurry of diplomatic activity in Northern Ireland, where the current post-Brexit trading arrangements have led to a political impasse, and in Brussels. Our correspondent there, Jessica Parker, told us about Mr. Sunak's next moves.
He's off to the Munich Security Conference along with many other politicians. And we had confirmation today that among the people he will meet is the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Why is that important? Well, the negotiations have essentially been taking place between the UK government, of which Rishi Sunak is the head, and the European Commission, a branch of the EU of which Ursula von der Leyen is the head. Now, some people I speak to are really downplaying this meeting, saying, look, they're not going to seal a deal at the Munich Security Conference on an issue like this. But others I speak to actually really think that it could be a place where they iron out some of the remaining problems that they can't agree on. But I think the big picture in terms of where we are today is a deal on trying to resolve problems with these post-Brexit trading arrangements for Northern Ireland may well nearly be done, but whether it is actually sellable to quite important parties and groups in the UK, big question mark over that.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Because the key hurdle all along has been unionist opposition in Northern Ireland.
Yes, and the feeling amongst unionists, particularly the Democratic Unionist Party, which is currently refusing to go back into power sharing, is that they feel a trade border has been created down the Irish Sea between Great Britain, Wales, Scotland and England and Northern Ireland. That is a big problem for them, and they really want to see checks on goods that have been created as a result of the Northern Ireland Protocol, this post-Brexit trade arrangement. They really want to see those checks gone. We know the negotiators are trying to ease checks on goods, whether that is sort of standard products, whether it's supermarket food, but the extent to which they manage to ease those checks or even eliminate them will be key. And then you've got some other totemic issues around how this treaty is governed and whether it really leads to a place for some Conservative MPs where they feel that full sovereignty, as they would put it, has been restored after the UK's exit from the European Union.
Jessica Parker. Still to come on this podcast, the mysteries surrounding the disappearance of a Chinese tech billionaire. As the number of deaths from last week's earthquakes in Turkey and Syria rises literally by the thousands every day, so too does the anger. Images show newly built residential blocks collapsed like sandcastles. This despite tougher building regulations brought in after another devastating earthquake more than 20 years ago. Now many in Turkey are blaming corruption and the government's desire to drive a construction boom for the tens of thousands of building collapses. More than 100 arrest warrants have been issued, but the opposition say the authorities are simply trying to shift the blame. Nick Beek has been investigating one building in Gaziantep in the heart of the earthquake zone where more than 100 people perished.
Bahattin Ashan, an ex-security guard at this complex, films on his phone as he asks if anyone can hear him.
It was like the apocalypse. Even now, as I'm telling you this, I'm still shaking.
In all, he dragged 7 people to safety. At least 136 others died here. As the ruins of proud family homes are unceremoniously cleared by diggers, a pile of personal possessions grows on the pavement. It is a deeply upsetting museum of lives extinguished. Homework, dolls, cooking pans, and family photos. Scouring the heap and sobbing inconsolably, 65-year-old Emel Felik. Everything is gone, she tells us, as she mourns her cousin. But soon, we see anger too.
It was an accident waiting to happen. 6 months ago, the head of the Residents Association told us about the problems of the building. She said our buildings might collapse at the smallest earthquake. Let's strengthen the pillars, she said, but nothing happened.
We wonder if this is something our former security guard, Bahattin Ashan, who saved those 7 lives, saw when he worked here.
I witnessed the defects with my own eyes. When I touched the concrete columns, it would crumble to dust in my hands, as though it wasn't concrete at all. The iron was rusting in the columns. The rainfall was damaging and corroding the iron.
Across Turkey, the authorities have been quick to make arrests, including one man linked to our exclusive block in Gaziantep. His lawyer tells us that he wasn't the contractor, but that cheap materials were never used in the construction, and that subsequent work, nothing to do with him, may have weakened the building. The local authority says no formal complaints were ever made about the condition of the building, and so no inspections were ever carried out.
We've been here quite a few hours now, talking to lots of different people, and I guess just trying to take in the enormity of this. This is one of the most exclusive parts of the city. Property here, very, very expensive. And the picture we're getting is one of people knowing that there were problems here and simply nothing was done. And we're hearing this time and again across this country.
We want the government, let's prepare these buildings for the earthquake, let's test them. But they didn't do it.
Arriving to see the damage for himself is an opposition MP, Garo Paylan.
Unfortunately, in Turkey, these kind of earthquakes happen every 10 years, and people die, and they say it is a destiny. No, it is not a destiny. If we just do what the science says, nobody dies.
President Erdogan has urged the Turkish people to ignore those who he says are politicising a disaster, the scale of which could not have been prevented. But the story of this one complex reflects a broken system of crumbling buildings, an oversight that's flimsy at best. This at a time when seismologists warn Turkey and the millions in Istanbul specifically should be preparing for a much, much bigger earthquake in the future.
That report by Nick Beek. It's become a worrying norm in China. Another senior businessman has gone missing as President Xi Jinping continues his anti-corruption campaign. Bao Fan is one of the country's top tech investors and has funded major technology projects. His company, the private investment bank China Renaissance, says it hasn't been able to contact him for some days. Our correspondent in Beijing is Stephen McDonnell.
From the outset, I should say, in all of this, when we're talking about what's happened to Bao Fan, I'm going to engage in a fair bit of speculation here because we don't know, beyond that short announcement from his company, what's happened to him. But it looks like his disappearance is part of a pattern whereby these senior executives are taken away and questioned by the Communist Party's Discipline Inspection Commission as part of the anti-graft crackdown here, and sometimes they re-emerge and have to change their ways or alter the way the company does things, or they could find themselves facing more serious charges. But the announcement that he disappeared sent shares in his company tumbling, and of course that is because the first thing investors would have thought is it's got to be because he's being investigated personally for corruption. But it might not be that. It could be that he's being questioned in relation to other people's corruption, other companies and what they've done, because he's been at the heart of all these tech sector deals. He's put together these huge mergers of tech companies here. He knows where the bodies are buried, if I could put it that way. He would be able to tell investigators an awful lot about everyone in the top tier of China's tech sector. Now, that said, there was another executive from his company taken away in September last year for questioning. So perhaps it is something to do with China Renaissance. Who knows? As I say, I'm sort of speculating here, but it looks like his disappearance is in some way bound up in this anti-corruption crackdown.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. The star of Die Hard and many other Hollywood action movies, Bruce Willis, has been diagnosed with dementia. This comes after the 67-year-old actor announced last year that he was retiring because he had a condition that affected his speech and cognition. With more, here's Harry Bly.
In March last year, it was announced by his family that Bruce Willis had been diagnosed with aphasia, a condition that affects the left side of the brain, causing difficulty with reading, listening, speaking or writing. Now the actor's family have released a new statement revealing a diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia, known as FTD. Often, when you hear the word dementia, you think of Alzheimer's, a disease that causes a type of dementia that usually affects memory. Frontotemporal dementia is different. It affects another part of the brain.
As the name suggests, dementia in this case is happening in the frontal and temporal lobes. If the temporal lobes have the disease in them, a person has language symptoms. They speak less fluently. They lose the meaning of words. And if the disease is in the frontal lobe, what's affected is what we call executive functioning. And that's things like being able to plan or organize your day.
That's Susan Dickinson, the chief executive of the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration. The statement from Bruce Willis's family explains how his condition progressed from aphasia. Susan Dickinson says more of the brain has been affected.
If the disease happens in the temporal lobe, you'll get diagnosed with aphasia because you will display those language symptoms. If the disease is in the frontal lobe, you'll display those behavioral and personality changes. It does progress from one lobe to the next, and that's why it's called frontotemporal dementia.
Frontotemporal dementia occurs much earlier in life than Alzheimer's. Symptoms can begin in people in their 40s, 50s or 60s. As yet, there are no approved treatments to prevent, slow or stop the disease, but research and clinical trials are ongoing. Bruce Willis's family, in their statement, said that he would want to respond to this diagnosis by bringing global attention and a connectedness with those who are also dealing with this disease.
Harry Bly. As we record this podcast, India is preparing to welcome a dozen African cheetahs as part of efforts to reintroduce them into the wild, around 70 years after they became extinct in South Asia. The cheetahs are being flown from South Africa months after 8 of the big cats were transferred from Namibia. So why does India feel the need to reintroduce the world's fastest land animal on its territory? Professor Adrian Tordiff is a South African wildlife specialist who's been leading the transfer project.
The mortality rate during translocations was notoriously high, but we've been working pretty hard on that, doing and trying to understand exactly what the risks are and where we can mitigate them. And we've really got a very nice protocol now for the translocation, and I'm really happy to say that our chances of successfully getting them there are pretty good. Asiatic cheetah, which is just a subspecies of the cheetah, went extinct in India in 1952, although there might have been a few individual sightings through the 1970s, but then those faded away. And it's the only large carnivore species, only carnivore species that's gone extinct in India, in modern-day India. So there was a real desire to reintroduce the cat to the country. These ideas have been going on probably for the last 50 years. But gained sort of momentum in 2009 when there was a meeting in India of international experts of cheetahs, and they decided to pursue the possibility of getting cheetahs from southern Africa. The problem is that the Asiatic cheetah itself only currently occurs in Iran, and there are probably only about 12 individuals in the wild left there. So that's not a very good source population. We have in South Africa the only growing population of cheetahs in our metapopulation program, and we end up with a surplus number of cheetahs that need to find new homes in our range expansion program. So there are at least about 30 cheetahs that can go every year, and we've sent cheetahs to Malawi and to Zambia and to Mozambique. All we have is the 8 individuals that are in Kuno National Park in India at the moment. But they've adapted pretty well. You know, they're hunting by themselves. They've adapted to the environment there.
And that was Professor Adrian Tordiff. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly. The producer was Oliver Berlau. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
On the podcast Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Celebrating 13 awards, including Best Creativity Podcast, you'll learn from iconic creatives like Pixar director Domi Shi.
Go big, shoot for the sun, and then you can like land on the moon.
Actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I had to take responsibility for my own creativity.
And best-selling author Ann Patchett.
If you want to be better, you just have to keep doing it.
Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.